The Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio is on the air.
Hello.
Hey, is this Gene?
Yes, it is. This is Alex?
Yeah, this is me.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good, and you? Yeah, well, here we are now, so I'm glad we got to talk to each other now.
All right, so I guess we'll get started.
Right on.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema. Tonight, we're talking music with our very own hat trick of retro-traditional metal, Alex Gutierrez of Mortillery, Jason Decay of Cauldron, and Chris Bennett of Widow on the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Cinema, where the focus is on film that matters, cult, grindhouse, drive-in, independent, and underground film from the dawn of the talkies through the early 90s. Tonight we're talking music. First, we'll be speaking with Alex Gutierrez of Mortillery, a brand new band exploding onto the retro traditional thrash scene. Formed just 3 years ago in 2009, Mortillery has already been picked up for a major label debut on Napalm Records. With background in punk and a clear and obvious love of classic 80s San Francisco Bay Area thrash, Mortillery combines some seriously traditional stylings with some very modern touches and is poised to take the metal scene by storm. And just to give you an idea of what we're referring to, here's Mortillery without weapons.
Caucus right now. tonight we're talking music, and we have with us another brand spanking new band tipping into the retro vibe, this time mining the vein of classic old school thrash metal. Please join me in welcoming Alex Gutierrez, rhythm guitarist for the band Mortillery. Alex, welcome to Third Eye Cinema.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, man. I really appreciate it.
I was listening to this album for a few tracks before I picked up that this wasn't an adenoidal guy on vocals. Yeah, I'm really surprised. That's, you know, vocally speaking, Kara's sound is somewhere smack dab in the middle of Los Rockets, Sadus, and DRI with, you know, a dash of Bobby Blitz Ellsworth and a declamatory style she's got.
Yeah.
In terms of the band itself, you know, I think you guys lean a bit more towards Overkill with, you know, maybe a dash of Joey Belladonna era Anthrax, and it's more traditional. You got that whole Bay Area thrash sound down. It actually brings me right back to when I was a teen getting off on the first albums of bands like Heathen or Bloodfeast, Death Angel, Flotsam and Jetsam. You know, all those bands' second albums suck, but the first ones out of the gate are still on my playlist to this day. So best of luck on your next one.
That's exactly how I feel, and that's how we feel about our music, too. We're actually in the studio right now working on the second album, so we're just trying to keep that in mind.
Awesome. I've actually noticed more bands going the retro route that are influenced by the black and thrash sound from Europe and South America, like Bathory, Sodom, early Sepultura, and Sarcophago, than the more accepted U.S.-style Bay Area thrash thing. I'm not sure if that's just the influence of black metal on the kids coming up today, or if it's tougher to pull off something like Violence or Forbidden. What's your take on that?
I think it's just bands like Venom and stuff like that, like you mentioned, are just a little more, people seem to be really getting into that heavier things. I noticed that the main population of bands nowadays are doing a lot of death metal and things like that.
Right.
So I think what's happening is that there's people who don't want to go the death metal route, but they do want to, they want to play thrash, but they wanted to make it a little darker, maybe a little heavier, and making it like that, more like Venom-like and stuff like that, will help these bands create that sound. And, I mean, I like it a lot, too. There's a band called Witchhaven from the States who plays, like, dark and thrash, and it's awesome. It's amazing. But we feel more comfortable doing the old-school things. Anthrax, Metallica's Kill 'Em All, stuff like that is something that we have in our playlist all the time, and that's kind of what we get influenced by.
Right, because I like both. It's just I see more of the other, and I don't see too many bands doing what you're doing. And I was wondering if you had take, you know, being in the scene, why there's less bands going for the Bay Area sound.
Yeah, to tell you the truth, we honestly don't know. We notice it a lot when we go on tour and stuff like that, and when we play other shows, you know, we don't really seem to find other common thrashers. I mean, we get along with everybody well, but when it comes down to the point and to our music specifically, nobody else really seems to be doing that. And it's not that they don't like it, and it's not that they don't listen to it. I think it's just everybody's trying to be the next harder, the next faster, the next bigger thing, you know? And that's not really what we're about. We're not really trying to do anything specific. We're just playing exactly what we like and how we think that thrash should sound like, you know?
Right. So let's take this back a few steps. How did you guys all get together? Because I understand you personally hail from a punk background.
Yeah, that is true. I've been playing in a lot of punk bands before this. I even played in a couple of rockabilly bands and stuff like that. Mostly just my life since I was young. I've been involved in music, and just playing guitar has been everything that I've always done. I think my punk background is probably why it keeps us more old school, like you mentioned earlier, because we do get influenced a lot by anything from, you know, Broken Bones and Discharge all the way to the Ramones and stuff like that. So
right.
I think that punk influence, it's a very important key in our sound. We all got together. I think I was Miranda, the bass player, Kara, the singer, and me. We kind of just met at the bar, you know, watching bands play and stuff like that. And we got to talking on how we wanted to start a band that sounded that old school thrash. We all agreed that, like you said, Flotsam and Jetsam's first album and stuff like that, we all agreed that that's what we liked. And we wanted to, you know, bring that back out since there was nothing like that being played.
Yeah, because I was going to ask that. To your first point, you're right, because the whole key to old thrash was that it really was mixing and coming out of the punk scene. You know, most of us that were doing this stuff back when, or were into it, had been punks first, and then we got into thrash, and there was a lot of interplay.
Mm-hmm.
But to the second point, I was going to ask, what made you guys decide, you know, okay, I want to do old school thrash? Because above and beyond on the other considerations, you have two females in the band. You have Tara McCutcheon on vocals and Miranda Glebo on bass. And it's a bit unusual for a metal band to have about half the group on the distaff side of the equation. You either get all-girl bands like Kitty or Phantom Blue, or you get a female singer in an all-male combo, and yet you actually had three ladies in the band at one point.
Yeah, Emily was our original drummer, so you can imagine how much fun it was to have three girls in a band.
I know.
Now, all kidding aside, though, all kidding aside, it's been great. I mean, we've gotten both sides of the coin, really. I mean, a lot of people, as soon as we set up and they look that there's girls in the band, they just turn away and don't even care to stay and listen to what we play. And the other side of the coin is that everybody's like, oh, my God, it's girls in the band. Let's check this out, you know?
Right.
So it's worked out to our advantage and disadvantage. And the truth is we don't really care. I mean, it's not really...
Yeah.
it doesn't matter to us. I mean, it just so happened to work out that way. Me and Miranda, I guess, were the very first ones who decided to, okay, let's get a band together. And it was all because of that, because we agreed on the bands that we liked, that we listened to. I've never met anybody, another girl who knew as much, like, original old thrash as Miranda does. She's the one who I would say carries out the main influences when it comes to that thrash. She's the one that keeps showing us all these bands that she knows about that none of us have ever heard. So, you know, it just so happened that it happened to be girls. I mean, we didn't specifically go for it. We didn't want, like, it's not like we didn't go out to find a girl singer. It just so happened that Kara was really interested on what we were doing. And we've only had jammed maybe like once or twice when we met her. And she was like, wow, you know, right on. This is something that I can get into. Finally, somebody understands the kind of thrash that we want to do.
Right. Because, you know, it's not the kind of thing that us old schoolers expect from a female. You know, back in the day, there wasn't a hell of a lot of girls in that particular scene. You know, because you got Kat, you know, the great Kat, and Nicole Lee, who was the manager and then became the singer for Snow White. They're the only ones that really come to mind right away. And then you have to go out to more traditional metal for people like Leather Leon with Chastain, or Anne Boleyn from Hellion, Betsy Bitch, Doral Pesh, Lee Aaron. You know, it's traditionally been a male-dominated field, though that does seem to be changing now.
Yeah, for sure. I don't really know why it was like that. I mean, it's hard to believe that there was no girls that they were into it. I think maybe they just mentality was a little different. Maybe they just didn't have the balls to just go out and do it. You know, maybe they felt like they shouldn't. You know, maybe they felt that their place was different. But it's good to know that the female community is understanding that this is not a male-dominated world, and that we are a community. We're a bunch of, you know, musicians. We're metalheads. We're punks. And it doesn't matter what sex you are. If you can rock out, you know,
exactly.
Let's do it.
That's it. What I really like about your sound, speaking vocally, is that while she does throw in a lot of that scary screaming for a good portion of the running time, Kara's doing actual old-school thrash-style vocals. I mean, you know, you couldn't really picture death or black metal without growls and snarls, but metal bands are just using that everywhere, and it doesn't always fit. You know, it's starting to get a little boring. I'm glad to hear some groups like yourselves coming up who actually seem to get that, you know, that old-school sound.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. I guess, like, just the way our music goes is just that we couldn't do it any other way. That's what it comes down to. We just do what we know, and that's just what comes out on the record, really. If we tried to do something different, it would be obvious, and it would be awkward, and it just would not fit in.
Exactly. So you guys are from Edmonton, Alberta. Now, I know there's a traditional metal scene going on over in Toronto. I've had Skullfist and Cauldron on air already. And here in the States, things tend to happen on the coast more often than not. But speaking as a native New Yorker, from our perspective, you're way out there in the middle of nowhere, effectively, because Edmonton's more or less parallel to Western Montana down here. And the big selling point, I understand, is that you guys are home to the world's largest mall, and that Prom Night 2 was filmed there. And I also understand you got some oil sands drilling and fracking going on out there.
Yeah, that's pretty much what Edmonton's about.
So how provincial is it really? I mean, does what I'm assuming from, you know, being New Yorker to be a more woodsy environment impact the sort of music you're playing? Or is there any sort of a retro thrash scene out that way?
You know, I want to say no. I mean, there is a couple of bands. Another band that comes to mind from here in town called Tarantula. And they're a thrash band, but they're more crossover. They're more in the punk scene, really, than they are in the metal scene.
Right.
We find ourselves to be, like, pretty 50-50%. Like, we can play punk shows, we can play metal shows, and either or goes pretty well. But nobody's really doing the old-school thrash that we're trying to go for. I don't know if our environment really influences it. I think mostly it's just we just happen to find, you know, a group of five of us who like to do this kind of music, and here we are. I think our environment will probably influence us more when it comes to, let's say, bands like Toxic Holocaust. Like, we really like that kind of music, that toxic thrash and stuff like that. I can say that Edmonton would be a perfect example for that because of, like you mentioned, the oil sands and stuff like that, and just the community here. It's not really a music community, so we're just kind of doing our best to keep ourselves entertained and to not go insane.
Right. So it actually is as woodsy as I'm thinking, or is it just...
No, there is quite a few other bands here in town and stuff like that, but, you know, we have a hard time finding bands to play with because it's either they're too much on the one side of the coin or too much on the other, and we can't really seem to find other guys that are like-minded that want to do the same thing with us. I mean, there is lots of bands, and there's traditional heavy metal or just straight-up balls-out punk rock, you know, but nothing really in between out here.
You're also a very young band. I mean, you only formed in 2009. You dropped one EP last year, and now you're making your major label debut on Napalm with Murder, Death, Kill. So tell us a bit about the album and how you got signed to a major so quickly beyond just their A&R guys having good taste.
You know, it was just as big as a surprise to us as it probably is to a lot of people. It was nothing to it. When we went to record the album, you know, we did have an idea of what we wanted to do with it, to send it to labels and stuff like that. But we, you know, I mean, it's what are the odds, right, that somebody's actually going to listen to it, pick it up and sign us, you know? But what all we did really is to spend all the money that we had on the production value. I understand that that's very important. That's what labels want to see. You know, you can't just send a basement recording to them and expect them to pay attention. So that's pretty much all we did, is that we make sure that the production value on the album was great and made a press kit, sent it to them. And next thing you know, we got the phone call, and it's all history since.
Yeah, because I mean, it's really surprising. You know, there's bands that toil away for years putting out demo after demo and, you know, self-producing, and you guys are just like that. You just got picked up.
Yeah, we just got lucky.
But it's still surprising that it was so fast. I mean, it's like, it's almost like one of those Horatio Alger success stories that you never hear.
Yeah, it's really weird. Like, I'm really surprised. I mean, we're friends with a lot of other dudes around here that are in bands and people that have been trying for so long. And you know, you just, you know, we follow things on the internet to see what other bands are doing and stuff like that. And everybody's giving it their best. Everybody's trying so hard. And they've been bands have been together for years and just haven't been able to really break it through. And I wish I had an explanation to you why it happened to us, but we're just really glad that it did. And we're just going to keep on going. Obviously, we're doing something right, so.
I love your motto from your band website, Posers Will Die. I was a big thrasher and deep in the underground back in the late 80s, early 90s. And we used to go around scaring the crap out of, like, Bon Jovi and Motley Crue types. You know, it's all very punk, Adolf era Exodus. So that just brought that immediately.
It's funny, yeah.
Down, I saw it.
That's awesome. The label that we first put out Murder to Kill with, they're called Horror, Pain, Gore, Death. It's just a smaller label out of Philadelphia. The guy who helped us out put it out, he's the guy that came up with that. And, oh, you know, some people really remember, like you say, from back in the 80s where that was just like what you do on a weekend. You go around and...
scare poses.
I can't say that that's what we do. And in all honesty, I've gone to a few Motley Crue shows and stuff like that, and I did have some fun. So, it talks about the music, really. We believe that that's how metal should sound, and that's what we want to do. So that's kind of where that came from.
Right. So who came up with the cheesy cover art with the drag queen skeleton? Because that was really a flashback. It reminded me of some of the more obscure underground and thrash metal covers from back when.
Well, the idea came from us, and the design itself was done by our friend Todd Rocket. He's a tattoo artist, and he's done tattoos and a few of us in the band here. And I actually play in another band with him in a punk band he sings for. And he's just a really good artist. He's our friend. And all we wanted to do is just that, pretty much. And we feel that cover represents exactly what the music is, and we wanted to give it that old school feel. I would say it's very influenced by Toxic Holocaust cover, Overdose of Death, you know, and stuff like that. We wanted to have that feel, that toxic kind of, you know, imagery to it and stuff like that. And we all really like that style, so that's kind of what we like to go for. Municipal Waste and stuff like that, you know?
Right. Now, you had mentioned you were in another punk band. Kara actually sings with another band, Minax, who formed around the same time as Mortillery in 2008, and they put out an EP in 2009. So is that band an ongoing concern? And if so, how does it impact Mortillery to have her and you apparently juggling time between two bands?
No, it hasn't been a problem at all. At first, when we first started, we used to jam at Kara's house. And, you know, we were sometimes jam practices would overlap where Minax would still be jamming while we show up. And now, you know, we all get along. We're all friends and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it was never been a problem or any kind of competition or anything like that.
Right.
I guess it just so happened that we got a little busier a little sooner than they did. They still play a lot, not much live, but they definitely write lots of music and they record a lot. Their drummer, Tyson, has his own little studio, and they spend a lot of time in the studio recording and stuff like that. So they're still an active band, but just not much on the field as they are more like at home and stuff like that. But it's never got in the way or anything like that. It's always been just fine. And I mean, I played another band, and our drummer has also had other side projects and stuff like that. And we all know that this is our number one concern, right? Mortillery is first before anything else. So we make it work.
Right. Now, Minax, though, they're also a thrash band. So in what ways are you guys different from each other?
Mostly probably the influences. I think those guys, the guitarists and stuff like that, are more just into the specific metal scene, I guess, if you want to call it that.
Okay.
They don't seem to... We listen to a lot of punk rock, like I said earlier.
Right.
So I think that would be the main difference, is that they play thrash, but more influenced by metal. We play thrash, more influenced by punk.
I totally get you. So I ask this of all the Canadian bands I get on air, but what is it about the Great White North and inspires so much metal, and in particular, more traditional style metal, you know, the real shit? Because outside of the Raleigh scene with Widow and all those bands down there, we're still stuck in like Dumbo territory down here in the States. It's all aggro, new metal, juggalo types, hip hop. You'd think like Lawful Loser and the whole Pantera thing never went away. So what is it about Canada?
I don't know. It's really hard to say. Maybe because the population in the States is so big that you got so many people trying to do something different, you know, trying to be the next big thing. Where I guess here in Canada, we're not really too concerned about that. I think most of the bands here dedicated time playing just what they want and what makes them feel, you know, good.
Right.
Compared to this, and this is just what I think. I mean, I really don't know. I don't really communicate with too many bands from the States and stuff like that. But that's what I would imagine. I think everybody down there is just trying to just, you know, invent something new and try to hit the big next thing and stuff like that, and maybe that's why the music has progressed to new sounds compared to just keeping it, you know, I mean, why fix something that works, you know, like if
exactly.
It's not broken, don't fix
they
it.
They broke, don't fix it. So another
exactly.
Canadian question I got to ask, what's your beer of choice, or do you prefer to hang at Tim's?
Well, as typical as it sounds, I drink Pilsner. But I guess, I don't know what everybody else, we drink a lot of cider up here too. Lucky Beer, I don't know if you guys would even know our brands though. There's Brew Houses made in Saskatchewan, that's always great beer. You know, once in a while you got to have a Budweiser, I guess, but that's funny.
Yeah, because when I came up north, you know, the Canadian beers, it's like German beers, they're so much stronger. If you're used to watered down American beer, you come up there like, whoa, I'm not here for a loop.
That's awesome. Yeah, like, I mean, we're just used to it, right? So we don't even notice. But, yeah, I think Pilsner is my favorite brand.
So do you have anything you want to promote? Maybe share your own website and tour info with the listeners?
Yeah, we keep our website pretty updated. It's, you know, mortillery.com. You can also just find us on Facebook at facebook.com/mortillery. We don't really use MySpace anymore because MySpace sucks. It's really hard to use, and it's just dumb.
Right.
But our website and Facebook is where you can find most of the information. We're actually in the studio as we speak recording our next album. So we're not too sure exactly when Napalm wants to release it, since Murder This Kill just got released in Europe on June 29th and in North America on July 10th.
Right.
I'm sure that this next one's going to be a little while before it comes out. But that's good, though, because we'll have time to go through it and just make sure it's perfect, you know?
Well, with that, Alex, I'd like to thank you for joining me here on Third Eye Cinema. I'd certainly love to have you back on to promote your next album. You know, keep the old school fire burning and keep those heads banging.
Right on. Thanks so much for this opportunity. I really appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Okay, bye.
And to close out our interview with Alex, there's another one from Mortillery. This is Fritzl Cellar.
Here's the Fritzl of Change of Police, now saying he is guilty of all charges, guilty for rape, for incest, for enslavement, and finally guilty as well for murder.
Yeah.
and Alex Gutierrez of Mortillery, Jason McKay of Cauldron, and Chris Bennett of Widow, only here on Third Eye Cinema. Discussion on the retro traditional metal revival, we'll be speaking with Jason McKay of Cauldron. One of the earliest and most prominent bands of the scene, Cauldron arose from the ashes of Goathorn, a doom metal act dating back to the late 90s who gradually evolved into a more traditional melodic sound. But first, just to give you an idea of what we're talking about, here's Cauldron with All or Nothing.
Tonight, we're talking music. Listeners to this show or a sister show at our level will probably know that I'm a diehard metal fan going way back to my teens. So I'm proud to say we have with us this evening one of the most prominent bands of the recent traditional metal scene, Toronto's own Cauldron. Jason McKay, vocalist, bassist, and band leader, joins us to share some wit and wisdom from the headbangers capital of the Great White North. Jason, welcome to Third Eye Cinema.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
I've actually been stumping for you guys since I first discovered you a year or two back with Chained to the Night. You and Widow were always my favorite bands in the retro scene, and more recently I'd add Skullfist to that list as well. I was quite surprised to hear a sound like this coming out of such a young, current band.
Well, we're not that young anymore.
Right. So speaking of that, let's start from the beginning. Jason, your original band was Goathorn, and you started out in your hometown of Pembroke, Ontario, before you moved to Toronto. Now, Goathorn was a much sludgier, more underground affair. You know, Voyage to Nowhere is very much Venom mixed with Trouble and Cathedral, but even more detuned and swampy, if listeners can picture that. I like the title track a lot, but it sounded nothing like where you'd head a few years down the road.
Yeah, that's actually still my favorite Goathorn song, too. Well, we're still tuned the same. I think we've just, you know, after, when was that? That was like 12 years ago or something. Yeah. So I think we've been able to refine our sound over the years. Yeah, I mean, Cauldron is essentially a continuation of where Goathorn was at the time we left off. So
by the time you hit Storm in the Gates, it had already been a clear progression. I mean, the vocals aren't growled quite as much. There's a lot more melody thrown in the mix. The guitars, they seem to be less detuned to me. You even had a few dual guitar leads on Storm in the Gates and my favorite track, The Last Force, which you remade for the last Goathorn record. There's a definite move towards the Cauldron sound. So were you thinking along these lines even back then?
No, nothing was preconceived. It was all a natural progression. I think there was between Voyage to Nowhere and Storming the Gates, you know, Voyage to Nowhere was sort of one-dimensional, so
right.
I think we said to ourselves, you know, if this band's going to be sustainable, we should find a happy medium
right.
with our sound, and that was the Storming the Gates sound, I think. And I think ever since then, we've only tried to not change that or steer away from it, but just improve upon it. And even to this day, that's still pretty much our goal or our vision.
You also had a nod to earlier Canadian metal history with your cover of Sacrifice's Reanimator. So do you plan to cover bands like Thor, Metal Queen Early Aaron, or DC LaCroix now that you've gone towards the more melodic end of the scene?
No. Well, Goathorn did cover a Thor song as well. We've covered lots of stuff, but we've covered some harsher stuff too, like Slaughter. I don't know.
By the time of Threatening Force, you had, for all intents and purposes, adopted a recognizably Cauldron-style sound. I mean, Rising to the Night in particular, but it's all over that record. So, Brandon Wars left for another band, and you formed Cauldron in short order, bringing the demos for what would have been the next Goathorn record with you. So, how did you hook up with Ian Change? Because, no disrespect to Brandon, but Ian's a much more melodic guitarist. He really suits the new direction of Cauldron far better than Brandon would have.
Okay, well, around when we did Threatening Force, that was just those three songs off that were considered demos to us that were sort of more pro-recorded. And we had another six songs that were demoed that sounded awful. And between those six songs that were demoed that sounded awful, which were never released, and the three songs off Threatening Force, that would have been the next Goathorn album. Brandon was dabbling with his new band at the time, Zuku, and that sort of pulled away from Goathorn. So when we finally had it out with each other, I just put out the word that I was looking for a guitar player to continue on. And Ian was a Goathorn fan, and he heard about it, and he got in touch. And then he flew out to Toronto, and we took half of the songs that were going to be on that next Goathorn record, and that became the Into the Cauldron EP.
You've also changed your vocal style. You've dropped the growling and moaning of the Goathorn days, which I'm certainly appreciative of. Now, I know that's a big thing in the underground, and admittedly, it'd be kind of hard to picture something as aggro as like death or black metal with clean vocals. But you've been leaning melodic traditional since the second Goathorn album, so the clean vocals fit much better. What motivated the move from, you know, the more underground sludge doom sound that you were doing with Goathorn, especially in the early days, to what eventually turned to a rather polished traditional metal one? Because the two styles occupy very different spaces in the scene. There's not a lot of crossover.
Yeah. Well, we learned to play a little better. But on the very first Goathorn demo we did back in 99 or 2000,
right.
I actually tried to sing on that, and it's awful. You know, my voice is cracking all over the place. And the guys said, you know, you can't sing, so don't sing. And when we did Voyage to Nowhere, I was clearly not trying to sing because I couldn't. As we went on, I guess I got a bit more comfortable with my voice. And I had practiced too, you know. I'd because I wanted to be a half-decent singer, so I would always practice, and I guess just as time went on and I got more experience, my voice progressed until the point where I was able to sing a little bit, so
right.
Still don't consider myself a good singer. It's still a struggle for me.
You've had a bit of a revolving drummer chair. I mean, Chris Steve is actually your fourth. It's a bit Spinal Tap in that respect, no?
Yeah, sure. He's not with us anymore either.
Oh, wow.
Now we just have, we're doing a new record, and we have our drummer from before Chris Steve, Chris Wright, the other Chris, who was in the band for about 8 months and never recorded with us. He came back to do the new record with us, but he's not staying with the band. So we still don't have a drummer.
Wow. So what's that all about? Are you just, you know, they don't want to stick with you, or is there something?
Well, I mean, it's hard to find a good drummer.
That's true.
You know, every drummer we know is in two or three bands, and when you do find a good drummer, they're spread thin, and for whatever reason, I don't know, we just can't find someone who's on the same page as us, you know, who's willing to, like, who loves the music as much as we do, or is as passionate about it to be in this band at any expense, basically, you know?
Yeah.
And our other, like, Chris Wright's our other drummer, he's got a paying gig where he plays drums and makes good money, so that's
right.
He gets to play drums and it's his day job. If it was truly down to just his passion, I think he'd be with us, but that's the way it works.
Right. Getting back to Into the Cauldron, it's a rather brief 1-2 punch, but again, there's a fairly stark divide separating this EP from even Threatening Force, which was just a year or two earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Even though these were demos that you intended for the fourth Goathorn record, the only thing that sounds the same is how you have this tendency to lapse into a little bit of the old growling every so often, but otherwise it's very clearly a Cauldron record. Tell us about the alternate cover thing with Chained to the Night, because what I guess was the original is much better, with the naked girl laying down in a more submissive pose with her important bits covered by chains. But the replacement cover, where she's clothed and sitting up fighting to break free of the chain, was this for Walmart or the Bible Belt contingent?
Yeah, whoever was distributing the record in the States wouldn't take the cover with her lying on her back. So we just went through the photos from that session and found a more appropriate one, I guess, for the U.S.
For a compromise, it's not too terrible. You know, you could say you stuck to your guns a bit, but by comparison, it's a bit of a cop-out still. Like, you know, how they started putting generic safe covers on old Scorpion records back in the 80s. You know, anyone can see the originals were much better and made for great poster art as well. This was also the album I discovered you from. And I was impressed how you killed two birds with one stone in covering Black and Blue's Chains Around Heaven, because not only was it another classic track from the somewhat neglected band, but it had chains in the title as well.
Yeah, that's all that chain stuff's a coincidence. We didn't really realize that was happening at the time until it was all done.
Yep,
like, oh, fuck, there's a lot of chains going on this record. Actually, that song wasn't supposed to be on the album either. We usually record, you know, two or three extra songs besides the album tracks that we don't intend to go on the record. But the people at Earache really liked that one and really wanted it to go on the record, so we let them put it on.
So do you usually keep those tracks around for EPs or, you know, singles or something?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess if we were going to do, like, bonus tracks or something, or, like, a reissue or something down the road.
There's a very strong Killer Dwarves meets Dokken meets early Black and Blue feel to the record, particularly in Chained Up in Chains. You've got that hard-edged melodic sound of, like, 1983 to 1985 down pat. Like I mentioned earlier, the guitars make a real leap from the earlier Goathorn material into being quite credible. This is definitely one of those records where I could put it on the aging vets of the scene and have them guess when it was made, knowing they'd be dead wrong by about 25 years removed.
Hmm. Well, I think that's where Ian's influence comes into the band. I think Chained Up in Chains was the first song that me and Ian wrote together, where I had taken some of his licks and made them into a song.
We touched on this earlier, but it's a major point, so I'd like to address this fully. While it's much appreciated by the vets from back in the day like myself, what leads you to adopt the retro route?
Well, it's retro to some. To us, it's the only thing we know. You know, I think we're fans first, and our sound comes from the stuff that we listen to and love most. So for us to play anything else wouldn't be right, you know. Not going to look around and see what's going on and play something just because it's popular at this point in time. You know, that wouldn't be. We're fans first, so we're just playing the shit we like. You know, or a product of what we listen to, I guess. I don't know.
But, you know, even saying that, it's strange because you likely grew up during grunge, I mean, the heyday of Lollapalooza and the whole rap thing, where musicianship was, to say the least, not encouraged, and it was often actively frowned upon. You know, even the flashiest shredders and the biggest glamsters started covering themselves in tattoos. They started growling and screaming. They simplified their songs into these chunky Neanderthal riffs that all sound the same. Kind of like...
Well, they want to be cool. We don't give a shit about being cool.
You know, there's a lot of, like, misery, hard drug use, shoegazing. In fact, you shouldn't know from when you grew up anything but this crap just by dint of the times you grew up in. So where does this passion for such long-lost ideas, this musicality and self-expression come from? I mean, where are you hearing all this stuff?
Well, that's the shit I grew up on, too. I mean, I think the earliest stuff I heard was AC/DC and Metallica. And from the first time I heard The Four Horsemen, I was hooked. So that's my roots. That's where it starts for me. And other stuff like Guns N' Roses as well, I remember. And Def Leppard, that being some of the earliest stuff I heard back when I was a kid. And it just sort of stuck with me, I guess.
Let's talk a little about the retro metal scene, and specifically in terms of the traditional sound, because there's like a retro thrash and a retro death metal scene as well. But Toronto has, at the very least, you guys and Skullfist. But I know there's other bands up there. So do you guys all get on, or does this look like the competition? Or
no, it's not a competition, I don't think. Yeah, we get along. I mean, we've known Skullfist for years. We hung out with them many times, done shows together. It's all good.
Because there's pockets elsewhere, like Sweden's Enforcer or White Wizard in L.A., but there's definitely something of a scene going on in Toronto, and there's another one down here in Raleigh, North Carolina, with Widow and Viper and a number of others. Why do you think it's such a small scene, relatively speaking, and so precisely concentrated in certain areas like Toronto and Raleigh?
I don't know. I think because once the people that are into that scene or that music see something happening somewhere, they sort of gravitate towards it. So we've been in Toronto now since, well, Goathorn moved here in 2001. And at the time, there was, if we were going to do a show, it was either with a death or black metal band or a rock and roll band. And I don't know, since then, you know, we've seen other bands or musicians interested in the same kind of music that we're doing come to the city, either bring their band or form a band in the city that's, you know, more like that. And over the years, I guess, sort of a scene developed.
Yeah, because I was talking about that with Chris from Widow, and I think that what might be happening is you get a band like yourselves or Widow, and they're out there playing, and nobody else is doing this. And other guys see it and start forming their own bands and doing the same thing. And all of a sudden, it just kind of builds. Jackie was saying something strange, you know, Jackie Flora from Skullfest, that in Toronto, at least, it seems like there's a lot of bands out there, but he said the scene's actually pretty small and just that everybody who's into it is in a band. Is that true?
Yeah, a lot of people that are, you know, the people going to the shows are also in bands as well.
And you're also
I always thought, though, that of this of metal, like 80% of the fans are
in their own
are also in bands or something, you know, because everyone's so into it and so passionate about it. But, like, yeah, a lot of the bands, a lot of people in bands here aren't even from Toronto. Like, I'm not originally from Toronto. I know, well, some of the guys in Skullfist now are, I guess, are from Toronto, but when they originally came here, they were from up north.
Right.
In Midnight Malice, they're from out west, I think, Calgary. Right. Can't think of any more bands off the top of my head, but I know a lot of the people don't originate from here. They just sort of come here because there's a good circuit here. There's, you know, it's a good place to network and to do, there's lots of clubs you can play, and whatever you do can be spread further from a major city as opposed to a small town somewhere in northern Ontario.
Barring the Raleigh scene, why do you think the whole traditional metal scene, whether it's the younger retro-oriented bands or the original bands from the 80s getting back together and touring again, falls primarily outside the States? Are we really surrounded by nothing but boneheaded, aggro, new metal types, rappers and juggalos down here?
Well, I think that shit exists everywhere. I don't know. I don't know if it's the TV or the radio or what everyone's force-fed.
Yeah.
Too much pressure to fit in, and I don't know. I really can't answer that.
One pitfall that I noticed several bands in the scene tend to fall into, which I have to say is very much not the case with the ones I've been championing and interviewing, is that there's several bands out there that fairly slavishly follow the model of a particular band. It's like the Iron Maiden cover band of 2012 or the Judas Priest cover band of 2012. And, you know, honestly, I wasn't all that much of a huge fan of those really big bands like that back then either. You know, they're a bit too stiff and stodgy and didn't have the variety of musicianship down here in bands like yourselves or Widow, for example.
Yeah.
You know, it's fairly obvious that you're absorbing various influences from various bands from the heyday of metal rather than locking in and saying, let's be Ozzy or whatever.
Oh, of course. I mean, I listen to a wide variety of shit. And when it comes to writing songs, I mean, I know what our band sounds like. And, you know, we've sort of established the sound, and that's our sound. And we sort of can't help it between my vocals and my style of playing bass and Ian, the way Ian plays guitar or whatever. We've developed our own sound, and we know what that is, and we know how to get it. So that being said, we can sort of take the most important thing for us is songwriting. So we could take a good songwriting idea from anywhere, put it through the cauldron filter, and, you know, because we don't just want to sound like this band or that band, you know, we have our own sound and we can get it going.
You know, getting back to the band itself, let's talk Burning Fortune. Amazingly, if anything, you become even more polished than you were on Chained to the Night. And I think it's actually a more consistent album as well. While Chained to the Night had a very strong opening, it got a little weaker towards the middle before closing on that Dead on Cover, the Black and Blue track. Burning Fortune is pretty consistent throughout. It actually feels like it's a short album because it never really wears out its welcome.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's a standard length. It's like 40 minutes or something. We had a lot of time to work on that one. We also had a solid lineup, like with the drummer situation around that era, which helped. We weren't worrying about a drummer as much. Like with Chained to the Night, we didn't have a drummer at that time either. We had Deal Rider.
Right.
Learned the songs from a demo that me and Ian played on, and came in 2 weeks before the album, rehearsed with us, and then recorded it. So it's not really got a lot of band feel. Whereas Burning Fortune, we were able to rehearse as a band for like a year or something before we recorded that. We were a band for almost, like, with Chris on drums for almost a year before we recorded Burning Fortune. So there was lots of time to write and rehearse those songs as a band, which I think helped a lot.
You know, there's more of a feel that it's like you were channeling bands like Obsession, Lightning Strikes Era Loudness, Love You to Death Era Lizzie Borden, LA bands like XYZ, Dokken, Hellion, that kind of sound, a very aggressive yet very melodic sound at the same time. And you'd already mentioned the drum situation. I was going to say, I also mentioned that you can really tell there's been a change in the drum school because there's a more aggressive, loose, organic sound than in the previous stuff you did.
That has more to do with the change of producer, or because we had, I mean, all our records are recorded the same. They're recorded live and raw, and they have a very organic feel to them because we record all the bed tracks live in the same room.
Right.
On Chained to the Night, we did that as well, and then we sent it to Neil Kernan to mix it, and he replaced all the drum sounds and chopped it up, and it sort of lost that feel. With Burning Fortune, we went back to an old producer who we knew well, Jameson Elliott, who also did the first two Goathorn records, and we used the old formula where we, you know, record the bed tracks live in a room as well, but we also mix it to sound like that. We don't try and suck the life out of it in post-production. We try
to get the lost sound, I guess.
Yeah, it's us playing together in a room, and we just roll with that, you know?
Yeah, because there was a couple points I wanted to hit on that, because one thing I was going to say was that I put it to the drummer, and I was going to say, Chris Steve's a definite improvement to my ears, because, you know, you actually notice that he's there. You know, on Chained to the Night, you didn't really notice the drumming as much, whereas Burning Fortune, you can hear that he's there and he's playing. It's like, you know, this guy's pretty good.
Wait till you hear the new one, because the drums are, again, another step ahead of the last one, so.
Another thing that really stands out is to production, like you were saying. I thought that this one also included Neil Kernan on the mixing end, but that wasn't true? It was just the first record?
No.
Okay.
That was just Chained to the Night, yeah.
And it's weird because, you know, this guy was responsible for two of the three best Queens records. You know, he did the AP and Rage for Order. And then he was involved with a couple of Dokken records like Under Lock and Key and Back for the Attack.
Yeah.
So you would think that this would be really there, and yet the production is so much better on Burning Fortune than it was on Chained to the Night.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that could be a few different reasons. One could be, you know, Neil Kernan has modernized his sound. The other could be that we spent way more time, I think, mixing that record than we did actually recording it. So he probably took a pretty sloppy recording and tried to clean it up a lot, you know, whereas Burning Fortune was the opposite. We spent a lot more time recording it and less time mixing it. So you get the more natural, organic feel to the record as opposed to the one that's been over-processed.
Even though
Chained to the Night is not nearly as over-processed as most records these days, but...
Oh, not at all. No, I'm not
for
saying
our
that
standards,
by comparison.
For our standards, it is.
Exactly, by comparison. You can really tell the difference. I mean, I was going to say, I didn't know the details behind it, but this record does not sound like the usual Pro Tools home studio mashup. It actually sounds like it was recorded in the studio and physically produced. You notice layering the sound. It's much fuller. It's more organic and open sounding. There's room to breathe in there.
Yeah.
Then you got multiple guitar tracks, dual leads, harmony vocals. There's more reverb and echo in the mix. It sounds to me like some actual thought went into the song structure and production, which doesn't seem to be the case with modern music production methods in general. You know, everything's so flat and uniform right down to the level of the waveform. Because, you know, it's hard to stand out when the final product always comes out sounding so homogenous.
Mm-hmm. Well, we also tried to master the record with in that sense, too, you know, so it would have more dynamic range and not just be loud and flat.
Exactly, because that's what happens with Pro Tools.
Well, I mean, it doesn't have to happen with Pro Tools, but people just crank the shit out of it and it loses all of its feel, I guess. I don't know.
Exactly. You get that flat waveform, and it's like, well, it's loud, but I'm not, you know, there's no natural feel to it. It doesn't sound right to me at all.
I think that's changing again. I think people are starting to get sick of that, and now it's just sort of trying to bring it. More people are getting into the fact of mastering a record to sound good, not just loud.
In terms of the record itself, there's an epic feel to a lot of the songs, particularly stuff like Tears of Come and Queen of Fire. There's that strong Doc and XYZ feel on tracks like I Confess. It's really a strong album all the way around, and it actually beats Chain of the Night all the shit. And I love that album. This is the kind of album that would have gotten heavy airplay back around 1987, particularly among my circle of friends, but even among the metal radio stations I was listening to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at this rate, you know, I can't wait for your next one. You said you're already working on it. When is that coming out?
We're aiming for October.
You got a title on it yet?
Yeah, we do.
Oh, you don't want to announce it yet?
Well, we haven't announced it yet. It's called Tomorrow's Lost. It hasn't officially been announced yet, but I don't care.
And you said you got your last drummer back again, Chris.
Chris Wright. We started our first band together when we were 15, back in 95.
So this is all before Goathorn and everything?
Oh, yeah, way before Goathorn.
So what happened? He just went in with other bands? And...
You know how people grow up and grow apart and do different things before they come back together? Shit like that.
That's actually the case with a lot of people now. I've been finding some friends I haven't talked to for 25 years plus on Facebook. And actually, this radio show is a product of the fact that I'm talking to some guy I haven't seen since high school again. And we're doing shows together. You've also put out a few videos. You got a typical live and concert video for Chained Up in Chains, and this more music 80s style story video for All or Nothing. I posted this video on my Facebook page when it came out, and I was pointing out to friends of mine that this is my life. You know, I'm the first guy in the office job totally fed up with his lifestyle, and I'm the second guy. Only my exit from stock work was a little more dramatic, and with pallets of boxes getting knocked out of my way out the door. But, you know, it's a great video. The humor, the overall sentiment, I very much appreciate it, particularly in this day and age when even the youth can be very conformist and career-oriented. Oh, okay, what's my career going to be? I'm going to work my way up in the business world, whereas you're just like, you know, screw this. This isn't where it's at.
Well, we just made a video about sort of how we really feel.
Exactly, right.
Yeah, you know, reality meets, I guess, fantasy. We'd love to tell our work to fuck off, but got to pay the bills.
That's it. We all got to make a buck. It's a bit of a Canadian stereotype with Bob and Doug McKenzie and all that, but I know you had a predilection with Goathorn to celebrate the virtues of beer. I mean, there's photo shoots that you posed around a keg. There's another one with the band kind of passed out. You used to sign off earlier interviews with stuff like beers and cheers or comments about brews. Are you still focused Michael Jackson style, being the beer hunter, not the singer, on the sublime delights of a fine lager, or have you moved beyond that image these days?
Oh, I don't know. That sort of became part of our lifestyle, so I guess it would show up in the band imagery as well. Yeah, it's...
Because I don't hear you guys talking about it as much as you did back in those days, so I'm wondering if you're still that focused on it, or if it's just like, you know, everybody else, like, hey, I want a beer or whatever.
Yeah, it's just there. I guess we got used to it being there. Talk about it as much, I don't know.
Why is it that Canadian beer, like German beer, packs a hell of a punch compared to the standard piss water American brews?
I don't know. You got to stay away from those major breweries.
That's for sure.
Got to get into those microbreweries. They brew better stuff.
So what's your choice of beers?
Moosehead's okay. I like dark ales, usually.
So,
dark ale, no matter what it is. I don't even know. I don't really drink anymore, so I'm starting to forget.
So I guess the beer thing is gone. That's why it's got so
Well, a lot of us Goathorn guys, the original three Goathorn guys, I guess you could say sort of ran into some problems with it at some points, and we've all gone through our phases and cycles and quit and started again at one point or another, and I guess I'm the last guy out of the three to join that trend.
Speaking of Canada, what is it about the provinces that produces so many power trios? You got Rush, you got Triumph, you got You Guys. It's not very common down in the lower 48.
I don't know. Maybe because Rush started it, so everyone was like, all right, Rush is the best band, so why don't we be a three-piece too? I don't know.
So,
I think for us it has a little bit more to do with it's easier to find the three right guys than it is to find four of the right guys, you know?
Exactly, right.
It's easier to keep a band together, keep a band on the same page. It's easier to travel, many
right.
reasons. Not that, you know, having a second guitar player would be nice, but it would also probably just make it more difficult or complicated in the long run, whether it's keeping it together or finding
right.
another person that you need to get along with, shit like that. We just keep it simple. Three's simple, so that's all we need.
So do you really eat welfare wedges, or was that more of a gag? I'm referring to the recipe you contributed to the Mosh Potatoes cookbook.
Yeah.
But, you know, and that book taught me that metalheads just love Mexican food. I think just about every recipe in the book involved chili, hot sauce, jalapenos, and cheese.
Well, because they're all hungover, and they need salty food. Yeah, that was something I was making a lot at the time. Because, I mean, when you're in a band, you're always trying to find ways to eat cheap
right.
on the road, whatever, when you get home and you're broke. And I guess around the time Steve asked me for a recipe, that was something I was making a lot. So I just wrote it down off the top of my head.
So you have any plans to play down this way in the New York area? Because I know that Chris was telling me that there was plans for you and Widow to play with Paul Di'Anno in New York, but that fell apart?
Yeah, once again, Paul Di'Anno struck. I guess, yeah, we were going to do a tour, North American tour with Paul Di'Anno, but he canceled as usual. So I don't know what our summer tour plans are now. I think we're still trying to work on something for at least, you know, the East Coast and the States. Whether that's going to happen or not, we'll see. But
you'll definitely have to give me a heads up if you're coming down this way. You got anything else you want to plug, or did you want to point listeners to a website?
I'll point them to a magazine. Check out the new issue of Chromium Dioxide. Chromium Dioxide number 5. It's the best metal fanzine you're going to find out there, in my opinion.
Do you want to point to your website or
our website? I guess if you find Cauldron on Facebook, I guess that's our most active website.
Yeah, because I was going to say most of them seem to be dead.
But we don't really have like a .com type website. We don't
right.
at all, actually. We just usually post on the Facebook page or follow us on our Tumblr page. That's where we post most of our updates, whether it's studio or touring or whatever.
Well, let's get on anything else.
No, I guess that's it.
All right. Well, with that, Jason, I'd like to thank you for joining us here on Third Eye Cinema. And
thanks so much for having me.
We'd love to have you back to promote your next album when that comes out.
Anytime. Well, it should be coming out around October. So.
All right.
Stay in touch. All right, Gene. Thanks, man.
And to close out our interview with Jason, here's one last track from Cauldron. This is Chained Up in Chains. Stay tuned up to the wrap for one more from Cauldron's new album.
Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, Alex Gutierrez of Mortillery, Jason Decay of Cauldron, and Chris Bannon of Widow. I'm here on Third Eye Cinema. Last show's interview with Chris Bennett of Widow. Where Cauldron have been the leaders of the Toronto scene, Widow have spearheaded the Raleigh scene, with numerous like-minded bands springing up in their wake. In this part of the interview, we discuss how Widow started off as a death metal band, and some more philosophy and approach to music, dialing it back and finding your own voice, putting the human back into music, and influences versus copycatting. But first up, here's an older track from Widow, off the On Fire album, which is where I discovered them from. This is Dead End.
I found you, you're an angel from above.
So that's the big question. Why retro metal? Because you're a young band. You weren't really there back when this stuff was all the rage. And you grew up with, like, tattoos and hard drugs crushing the metal scene. And then grunge came around, gangster rap, and the screamcore aggro crap that took its place afterwards. It's far from the in thing to actually display musicianship, melody, and songcraft. Even today's pop music has devolved to the point where some dumbo comes up with a good chorus and doesn't bother to build a song around it. It's just a chorus over and over again. I think I actually started with the country crossover, people like Shania Twain and Garth Brooks, where they write half a verse and a chorus or a piece like 15 times in the course of a four-minute song. It's like Demolition Man with the mini songs that really commercial jingles. You know, they aren't songs, they're ditties. It's like, you know, where does this all come from? Because, you know, you're a good player, you have a fantastic sense of melody and harmony. You build songs in the old school way without being slavish about copying any band in particular.
Well, the thing is, with me, I didn't see a lot of the 80s metal. My sister is older than me. My big sister is 11 years older than me.
Right.
So I was getting into this at a very young age. Now, granted, I mean, some of the bands I started off with, like my first band that I really got into as a kid was Quiet Riot, No Metal Help album, which I still love to this day. But, you know, that sort of progressed me into stuff like Metallica, Maiden, Priest, you know, that kind of stuff, and ultimately thrash and death metal. But yeah, so I did catch some of the 80s there, and, you know, so to me, that was the music that was always, I mean, the first thing you get into is usually the most near and dear to your heart, always. It's like your first love, you know, and, I mean, that's really what led us to do Widow, because that was where our heart was at and where it's always been, and that's kind of where we felt the most comfortable. To me, traditional metal, I mean, that's sort of just been, no matter what, even as a teenager, when I was getting to thrash and then sort of progressed on to death metal and whatever else, black metal, and I still love all that stuff. Traditional metal was like the constant,
right,
you know, in my life, and man, that's, you know, it always will be. So it comes very natural for me to write stuff like that.
Right, because, I mean, we're talking about how you came out of a death metal band, and, you know, like I said, that, you know, the earlier death metal bands did have a good sense of melody, and, you know, it was still coming from that same.
Oh, for sure. Well, me and Johnny started playing. I mean, I had several bands, you know, as a kid, as a teenager. I had a band called Despondent, which was kind of like melodic death metal. And, you know, we did a demo and actually had a song on a compilation at King Fowley's label, King Fowley of Deceased. It's called Midnight Offerings 2. So we did have a song on that. And that was in the, I guess, in the early 90s.
Right.
And then me and Johnny kind of came together, and we formed a melodic death metal band called Sorrow Bequest.
Right.
And we basically just did a demo. But the funny thing is, you know, we were so serious, like, about that band. I mean, we were just sure that that band was, oh, man, we're just, you know, like anyone young starting a band, you're
right,
really hungry. You're kind of just sure that, oh, man, this is going to take the world over or whatever. And it didn't happen.
Right.
And so we basically started Widow just as a fun kind of thing, just to jam around. I mean, Widow was intended for us to just play locally and have fun. And then, you know, here I am now doing an interview with you, and we're four albums later, and, you know, all the stuff we've done. So, you know, it was really, it goes to show that I guess you can't really plan where life's going to take you. You just got to go
exactly
along for the ride, you know.
Right.
You can try to plan it the best you can, but you also got to just go for the ride. And I'm very grateful, because I didn't think that Widow would be able to do much of anything, you know. And
right.
So, I mean, I'm proud of what we have done, you know. Of course, I want to do more. I mean, like anybody else, and I'm happy now that we're finally going to get the tour and everything else like that. But, I mean, you know, a big tour. I mean, we've done some tours. But with that being said, you know, I think things like that and makes you really appreciate it a lot more. So that's kind of where I'm at.
I also think it's interesting how a lot of the bands now, see, in the old days, if you watched bands that were coming out in the 80s or whatever, you listen to the first album and say, you know, Dark Angel, for example. You listen to that first album.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more or less like a traditional metal album. And then all of a sudden, they get, you know, this hardcore thrash thing. And you got a lot of bands that were, you know, with the death metal scene or the black metal scene or whatever, they had come out of being whatever was before it. Like, you know, Dark Throne. They were originally a Swedish death metal type band. They even recorded in like studios. And then
the
all of a sudden,
first album, yeah.
Right. Then all of a sudden,
Soulside
they went
to the Journey, yeah.
And, you know, this kind of thing happened all the time where a band would just be, you know, going out there, they'd try a traditional metal thing and they say, you know what, this is the new thing, or I'm into this, I want to make it more aggressive, and they go, all of a sudden they become a thrash band, or they become a death metal band, or they were a death metal band and they become a black metal band, whatever the case was. Now
yeah,
it seems like
true.
bands are reversing that. Like, you know, you start out in a death metal band, and then you got Widow, which is traditional. Cauldron used to be in Goathorn,
yeah.
That was it. And they were more of like a doom, you know, doom death kind of thing. And then all of a sudden, they started getting gradually more traditional and melodic, and then you have Cauldron. And so the direction seems to have totally reversed from, you know what, I'm tired of doing the traditional thing, I'm going to get more aggro. And now it's like, well, you know, I did the aggro thing, let's go for more traditional, because that's what we grew up on, and, you know, I want to bring some more melody and harmony into this. And it's really,
yeah.
You know, for somebody,
you're
who's
right, man.
This, for somebody who's been there for all this is, like, fascinating to me that, you know, we're going in the opposite direction now. There was a middle point, and then, you know, it diverges in both directions.
No, you're absolutely right. It has come full circle. And I think part of that is kind of like, you know, it's like they always create different kinds of Coca-Cola, you know, but
right.
At the end of the day, the one that's always going to last is just regular old Coke.
Exactly.
You know?
Right.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, you remember even in the 80s, they tried to change Coke, and people were so
horrible.
Mad. It's like they had to go back to the original formula.
That was it. They actually pulled the original off the market, and everybody was so upset that they said, forget
yeah.
it. They just dumped it. Like,
yeah.
Oh, that's it. New Coke, forget it. It was never happened.
No, people, the public just demanded that didn't happen. And, you know, I think with metal, it's really like that in the same way, because whatever, I mean, with anything you do in life, you only get one first of everything.
Right.
And the first stuff that I got into, the first metal that really moved me, that's going to be near and dear to my heart until my dying day. I mean, it always will be. And I think we did, well, just like playing, you know, melodic death metal. I mean, I still love all that stuff, too.
I do, too.
But it just got to a point where I'm really big about things being honest and being natural.
Right.
And there's absolutely no, I don't want to be a person who goes through the motions or
right, you
or whatever.
Force it.
And
yeah.
It was just like my heart was pulling me to do this, to do Widow, you know, just something for fun. And again, much to my surprise, we ended up, you know, getting signed, releasing an album, and then, you know, being at several, you know, all the things we've done, labels and shows and everything else. And that was not really, of course, we wanted to do that. I mean, everybody does, but you didn't really think of it as that it would happen.
Right.
It was just all about, hey, man, we love this music. We all love it. Let's just do it. But I think by putting that kind of honesty into it and not really having the pressure that comes with, you know, worrying about, oh, we've got to do this or that the right way or, you know, all these rules or whatever. When you just cast all that to the side, I mean, a lot of times that's when the best stuff can really rise to the top, because so many people follow the rule book, follow, oh, you got to do this, you got to do that. I mean, I don't care about any of that. I mean,
exactly.
I don't, you know, I just do what I love to do, and that's
totally
the beginning and end of it.
That's the same thing that happened, you know, like we're talking with the guitar playing thing. You know, I used to really, like, I got to do this, I got to do that. And, you know, I kept getting frustrated because I'm not good enough to be Paul Gilbert. I'm not good enough to be Yngwie. I'm not good enough to be Chris and Paul Terry. And then, but, you know, I was good in a different way, in a different light, and that was my own unique thing, and I just couldn't see it. And then later on, it's like you dial it back, and you're like, hey, wait a minute. And you just start relaxing, and it comes out, like we were talking the other day. It just comes out. And then people recognize that and say, wow, you know, this is interesting, this is new, this is unique, whatever, because it's not copying somebody else, it's not following a rule book, you're just, you know, getting out there and doing what you love, and people are going to come. It's like Lemmy said, you know, run up the flagpole, see who salutes. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing, because I guess it's like they say, you can't see the forest for the trees. I mean, you sort of realize, hey, man, I've been doing what I was supposed to do all along. I mean,
right.
I've felt the same way before, just exactly like what you're talking about. You just sort of, you go, oh, I need to be doing this, oh, I need to be doing that, and then you ultimately realize, hey, man, I do have a style, and it's this, and I need to sort of embrace this thing instead
right.
of fighting what comes naturally. I
think exactly.
That really happened with us, and now we just sort of know what it is, and that's what we go with, and I'm all about, like, being honest to myself and doing
right.
what I want to do, because I think that if you're not honest with yourself and, you know, look inward in that way, that people are never going to be able to sort to latch onto it and
exactly
embrace what you're doing.
there's so much fake stuff in our culture, especially nowadays with the media watching everybody all the time. Everybody's always on guard, and they got to present a public face, and then they go out with these group of people, and they got to present this face, and they go out and go home to the girlfriend. And
in the music, too,
face.
Man. I mean, in the pop music, I mean, it's all sounds like a big fake thing that was created in a computer.
Exactly. Well, a lot of it is.
I hate it.
You know,
I hate it. I mean, you listen to an old Black Sabbath album or old Van Halen or Kiss.
Right.
There are what people consider mistakes on those albums, but
oh, yeah.
That's the charm to me. That's the beauty of it. I mean, I would rather listen to those albums than just about anything because, you know, that was that guy's heart. That's what he was feeling, you know?
Exactly. I was actually reading something with Davey Vane. I don't know if you remember Vane. They were like a glam sleeves kind of band. But
I do remember Vane, yeah.
They were great, and he's still out there, actually, still recording stuff. And he had said something in an interview recently, and he was like, you know, I was recording this one take, and it came out, and I had a lot of passion there, but I was making mistakes, and then I just did it again until I got it perfect. And I was like, you know what? The perfect take, it just lost all the fire and the hell with it. I'm going to stick with what I got. It's got mistakes in it, but I don't care. It's better that way, you know?
Yeah, man, perfect is, I mean, what is, no one really knows what that is anyways.
Right.
People's definition of perfect today is far from mine, that's for
right.
sure. I don't think some fake drummed thing where someone presses a button and makes it all in time, and
yes.
That's not perfect to me. I mean,
yeah.
I like to hear old death metal or thrash albums where a drummer just presses a gas pedal and he just goes, you know?
Exactly. I'd rather hear like a Gene Hoglan or something than some guy that's using a click track and a D-bass, you know, because you can just tell it's programmed in the studio and they're sitting there playing this thing, and no matter how good a player they are or aren't, it's always going to have that fake feel, just like when you use Pro Tools in a lot of cases, when you auto-tune, you know, you're taking away a lot of what's, you know, essentially making the music what it is, just to make the
process. I agree, man.
It's
unnatural, and I hate it. I hate it. I'm totally
right.
against it. Can't stand it.
I wish
it wouldn't happen.
I know. What are you going to do? The only thing we can do is the people like us that understand, like, you know what, this kind of sucks, just don't do it. You know, do what you want to do. Get the music you want out there, and eventually people will catch on. Hopefully, you know, it'll become a trend. But
oh, yeah. We don't – there's – what many would consider mistakes all over our albums. We don't care, you know.
Exactly.
I don't. I mean, that's what I love about it, you know.
And, you know, like I said a few times, you know, along these same lines, you and Calder are fairly unique in that sense, even among the retro revival, because, you know, I mean, I'm grateful people are doing this at all, so don't get me wrong. There's nobody out there I'm trying to slag or anything. So,
oh, sure, yeah.
There's only a few bands who really do it right, you know, like capitalizing right, and you're one of them. So why do you
Thank
think
you.
It is... What is it that sets Widow apart from the pack?
Well, I think, for one thing, we've never really been striving to, like, just a lot of bands, and I, just from my experience of even dealing with other bands, it's always like, oh, man, well, you know, I mean, I really love the old Metallica, so, you know, I want to be just like that.
Right.
Or I want to be, a major culprit in that is Iron Maiden.
Yes.
People wanting to sound just like Maiden. There's probably more of that than anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was the same way when Cannibal Corpse came out. Suddenly there was 90 billion death metal bands that sounded
right.
exactly like Cannibal Corpse.
Exactly.
And I love Cannibal Corpse. I think I do. I like that band. But I don't really need to hear the 9,000th band that sounds just like that because
exactly.
there's no need for it. And I think with us, it was kind of just a conscious effort. Just, I mean, of course you have influences. I mean, I also
right.
laugh at that when I see people go, I'm inspired by myself. You know, I don't I get no outward inspiration. That's a lie. Of course
sure.
you do. And I just think with us, I've just sort of tried to just take a guitar and see what happens. You know, I think it takes time to sort of develop your own identity.
Right.
I mean, you do start out by sort of ripping people off, but I really think with us, I guess our musical limitations, you know, just made us just sort of sound like the way we sound.
Right.
I mean, I think that's really what it was. I mean, I couldn't rip off Yngwie if I set out to do it.
Exactly.
So,
I'm lucky if I can get a
you
lick
know,
or two down. That's it.
I mean, I can bust out my one move that I learned from his instructional video over and over
exactly.
again, maybe. But I mean, I'm not going to be able to, you know. And I guess with us, we just sort of, eventually, you sort of figure out, hey, man, this worked, and let's try this. You got to try stuff, and you got to experiment. But I know from the word go, we never wanted to be just like Iron Maiden or be just
right.
like Priest. Of course, I love those bands. They were major influences. But, I mean, we already have a Priest. We already have a Maiden. We already have all that stuff.
Exactly.
So
and
we've little, always sort of looked to be our own, forge our own identity.
And those little flourishes you always do on the guitar licks, you know, I'm hearing more of like Michael Denner into that. And, you know, Fast Eddie Clark even. You know, the same kind of like funny little sort of a trill you always do. And I do that myself, too, because I'm also influenced by Fate. But that's like the only thing I can say, well, okay, yeah, they probably got that from there. And then there's bits and pieces like, you know, that song sounds a little bit like a Leatherwolf song. That song sounds a little bit like a Crimson Glory song, but it never copycats. It's not like, you know, the Swedish death metal scene where you had Entombed, and then you had Dismember, and then all of a sudden there was like 25, 30 other bands trying to, you know, they all run the Sunlight Studios and try to sound exactly like
them. Yeah,
the
Sunlight sound, that chainsaw guitar, yeah,
right,
everybody had it.
The boss metal pedal.
The same can even be said for At the Gates or Dissection.
Right.
I mean, Dissection even had their own little legion of people that sounded exactly like Dissection.
Yeah, and At the Gates, I mean, you got, who's the one band that they're like a sort of popular, sort of punk aggro band? Howard Jones was in them.
Killswitch Engage,
right. I enjoyed that because it was obviously At the Gates. It was a total ripoff. And he even acknowledged, like, oh, yeah, we're really influenced by At the Gates. No, you're not influenced by them. You're trying to be them. You know, it's good because nobody else is doing that now, but or at least not, you know, in that kind of music. But it's slavish. You know, it's not like they're not establishing their own identity by doing that. They're just, okay, I like this band and let's do it. And they can do it pretty damn well. You know, they can go out there and be a cover band. But
sometimes people, I mean, people, yeah, exactly. Sometimes people catch, you know, at the right time, I guess. Maybe if a band is, well, I mean, you could really say, I mean, like Whitesnake, their 1987 album,
right.
Which I really love the album. It's really great.
Oh, yeah.
But a lot of people have said, oh, that's a complete Led Zeppelin ripoff. And I guess I can see that point. I mean, at that time, I was a lot younger in 1987.
Right.
So I just heard the album and loved the songs. I didn't really
right.
necessarily realize what ripping someone off even amounted
right.
to. But, I mean, when I look back on it now, it's like, yeah, I see that. But they even took that huge influence of Led Zeppelin and modified it sort of
yeah.
into their own thing. When you hear a Whitesnake song, you can go, yeah, this is Whitesnake. I mean, you know
right.
it.
Exactly.
And
there's songs where you can definitely say, oh, yeah, that's Led Zeppelin, but not the whole album, you know?
No. And everybody's got influences. And I mean, to me, I guess I've always listened to enough of a wider range of stuff. It's fun to me and exciting to sort of take different things and just sort of throw them into a bag and shake it up and then
and see what comes out, right?
Comes out.
Exactly. And, you know, you
yeah.
kind of Whitesnake, they were like AC/DC. They were originally a boogie band. You know, you listen to their stuff.
Yeah.
I was a big fan of their stuff from the 70s and early 80s. You know, you pull out an album like all the stuff that came before Saints and Sinners, you know, like Snakebite. You know, that stuff is great.
Yeah, man.
Trouble. I mean, you know, I mean, not Trouble
yeah.
the band. They're great, too. But, I mean, you know, Trouble, the Whitesnake album. I mean, you know, that's good stuff. And you know, when they had Bernie Moody and Mickey Martin in the band. You know,
oh, yeah.
So it's not like they just said, you know what, I'm going to do Led Zeppelin. Because, first of all, he came out of Purple and went in a different direction. They took half of Purple with him. He had John Lord in there. I mean,
and then his albums with Deep Purple are absolutely amazing. Burn and
are.
Stormbringer. Oh,
they're actually my favorites. I know it's not a popular thing to say, but I actually prefer them to the stuff that they did before that with Ian Paice.
I do. And I love, you know, I guess Mach 2 of Purple. I guess what was Coverdale was Mach 3, I guess.
Right, he was correct.
But
unless you count
I mean, I'm with you, man. I mean, look, the Coverdale stuff was absolutely amazing. It was just, it's one of those things with bands, I mean, it amazes me, bands like Deep Purple, too, who would have all these lineup changes and constantly change. Black Sabbath is the same way.
Right.
And all these different eras, like, it's like, man, you just, you have your certain ones that you latch onto. Like me with Black Sabbath, man, I love Black Sabbath with Ozzy.
Right.
But, man, with Dio, oh,
I know.
So great.
I
love
say,
that
the
so
Dio
much.
Stuff is almost as good, if not better. It depends what mood you're in, you know?
I agree. And you know, a lot of the times when I reach for Black Sabbath, it's Dio Black Sabbath.
Right.
And, you know, I love Ozzy. Gosh, love him in Black Sabbath. I love Ozzy solo, of course.
Right.
And, you know, but then you got, I mean, it's funny, you've got people who are like born again people. It's like that's the only Sabbath album they care about, you know. And I love that album. I mean,
right.
That's a killer album. It's really neat when the littlest shakeup can totally reinvent a band.
Right.
Like, well, not that losing a singer is little, but you know what I mean. You just,
no.
You take one ingredient out, and it's this whole different thing. And I think part of that also affects your sound when you're creating your sound and creating music. And I mean, I know sort of with us, like, Johnny, even his vocals, he's never tried to... I mean, I know in the beginning when we started the band, it was like, well, you need to sing really high. We tried that, and he struggled with it, and then it kind of like it just hit us all of a sudden. You know, you don't have to sing high all the time. Why do you have to do that? Just because other people do?
Exactly.
In traditional
right.
metal? No, you don't have to. Just sing the way you sing. I mean, like, we love Ozzy. Man, he's not going to be joining the National Opera anytime soon. I mean, and
yeah,
we kind of just sort of realized, hey, man, you can sing this whole song in a mid-range, you know, in like
exactly.
a tenor range or whatever. I mean, it just, we can do whatever we want. And it's like, suddenly this light bulb went off in my head, like, I can do whatever we want to do, anything.
Right.
And I think once I kind of figured that out, that's really when we were able to find a sound for Widow.
Exactly. And, you know, what you're talking about Johnny with his range, that's actually one of the things I like about it. He's got this pleasant, like, mid-range kind of – it's not quite a baritone, but it's like in that Don Dokken range. You know, it's like, okay,
yeah.
you know, nobody's
oh, yeah.
screaming at me. Nobody's screeching. You know, it's just – it's there. I'm like, okay, yeah, I could sing along to this. You know, it's not, like, bugging my ear, and I can just, you know, get into the song and pay attention to everything all at once and not be distracted by somebody be like, you know, like a Jim Gillette where it's like, ah! Or somebody that's screaming at you like a death metal band. It's like, okay, yeah, it's just, all right, it's good. It blends
yeah,
right
and
in.
I mean, look, and hey, man, Nitro is killer, man. I mean,
yeah,
like,
no,
OFR,
that.
It's a killer album. It's very impressive. But not everybody is going to be able to do that. Maybe not everyone should do that.
yeah, and not
I mean,
a lot of people want to hear that. Because, you know, you get a lot of people complaining about that. Like, my wife, she hates when those guys go really high. Like, the first thing she said to me when I it was like, because I was out of metal for a bit and I got back into it. And it's like, why don't all these guys sing really high or growl? you know? So some people don't even like that.
yeah, that's true. And, we just sort of looked at it like, hey, we want to write songs that maybe would make someone – see, I really dig stuff like songs that make, like, a kid want to pick up a guitar and start playing.
Right.
I mean, something that, you know, like Smoke on the Water. I mean, when I first started
right.
playing guitar, I learned Smoke on the Water like a bazillion other people in the world. And
exactly.
I felt like I was really something, you know, because I'm like, I can play Smoke on the Water. I mean, look at this. Check this out.
Exactly.
You know,
right.
or the riff from Crazy Train or something.
Right.
You just really feel like, wow. And, I mean, that's the kind of stuff that is really important. I think it's kind of missing in music today.
It's
I mean,
true.
Everybody feels that you've got to be at a certain level or you're just nothing. And Ritchie Blackmore is obviously an unbelievable guitarist.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I don't think anyone would argue that. But Smoke on the Water is a riff that basically anybody can play, and to me, that's what makes it great.
Exactly.
And we're kind of trying to go more in that direction where, hey, man, I mean, you know, maybe we can just write a riff that, it just seems like songs are not what they used to be to me. I mean,
yeah.
and maybe I'm wrong, but
No,
to me,
I think we've lost that whole principle of songcraft, and that's why I'm fascinated by bands like you guys going back and saying, you know what, I like this older sound where they used to actually have, and it's not just, okay, you got loud guitars, you got people singing high or whatever it is, it, you know, the flash of it. It's the substance of it where it's like, you know, this song makes sense. There's melody and harmony, and it resolves, and, you know where it's going to go once you get a little bit of it, and then maybe it'll fool you for a second, but it's going to go right back where you expect it to go, and it's not just
exactly.
like, you know, that's missing now. Everybody went too far off in the other direction, and now
I agree,
just,
man. It's almost like that's against the rules, like you can't do that, and I say you can,
yeah.
and those songs gave you something to latch on to, something to where you could. I know me, even as a kid, I would hear, well, like Quiet Riot. I mean, I heard
yeah.
that, and it was like I could really latch on to Bang Your Head.
Right.
You know, Metal Health will drive you mad. I mean, is that a technical song? No.
No, but
it's very easy, but it's great. It's
yeah, I mean,
so
like
effective.
20 or 30 years later, that still sticks out in your head. It's like, hey, that's a good song, you know?
It does, man, it does. And when you see today a lot of very young kids who, and I don't know if I mean, maybe this is from VH1 Classic or whatever, I don't know, but they are really attached to that stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, these are guys, it's kind of like unheard of. I mean, I went and saw Thin Lizzy and Judas Priest a few months ago. amazing right. show. But there were all these young kids there, and you just can't help but think, man, when I was younger, I don't really remember men who were senior citizens being considered cool.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. I mean,
and to see these kids worshiping, you know, Glenn Tipton and guys like that who are, I mean, Glenn Tipton, him, you know, he's got to be in his mid-60s, I mean, at least.
Oh, yeah.
Because Priest were kind of in their 30s when they really took off. So he's
yep.
got to be pushing 70 years old.
Yeah,
and,
true.
I mean, you know, same with Lemmy. It's just awesome to me that, you know, the culture has kind of changed in that way.
Right.
I mean, that's just really cool. I love that. And
you know, it's
I
almost
certainly
like the
hope the same for myself that we can keep going that long.
You know,
we don't
there.
Depend on money, obviously, so we probably can keep going forever, you know.
That's it. But, you know, it's kind of like the punk thing because, you know, one of my favorite bands, and, you know, sometimes people laugh, but, you know, Twisted Sister. I love that stuff. You know, before they went totally glam, but we're talking about, like, all the stuff that they did right up from the beginning up through, you know, Stay Hungry, that whole period. I mean,
those
are the simplest damn songs. I mean, if you cannot play those songs, you probably never touched the guitar in your life. And yet...
You should quit, yeah.
Yeah, right. And yet... Those songs are great. I mean, you know, you
they
put them
are,
on,
man.
And well, you just jacked them
you,
all
man,
the way up.
They are great. And I saw, we played that Rocklahoma Festival that I was telling you about. They, Twisted Sister played. I had never seen them before. I've listened to them, I mean, since Stay Hungry came out. I mean, I
right.
saw the videos on MTV and everything since I was a kid.
Right.
Always loved the band, but I'd never seen them.
Right.
Man, they came out and absolutely kicked ass. They were one of
yep.
the best bands there. The whole place, I honestly think it was the only time, and this was like a four-day festival, and even though we played for one day, we stayed for all 4 days just to hang
right.
out and watch. There were so many great bands. Man, I can't really remember another band that
right.
united every single person like that. I mean, it was just, but man, when you're just screaming, we're not going to take it. I mean, how can
yeah.
you not love that? I mean, it's just pretty hard not to have fun. You got to be a pretty miserable person to not
right.
want to scream, we're not going to take it.
Exactly.
I mean,
and, you know, and as simple as it is, it's deceptive because Eddie Ojeda is really a good player. You know, he's
oh,
very
yeah.
melodic. He'll keep the simple lines, but he can play. You know, I'll put that guy out there with some of the best of them. And
oh, absolutely.
Yet,
and, you know, I think one thing with songwriting today is it's like people feel like they have to sort of utilize every trick they know
right.
in songs.
Exactly.
And whether it be on drums, guitar, bass, whatever, those guys can do all kinds of stuff, but they just do what's best for the song.
Exactly.
And a lot of that is what's really lost.
And I did that stuff too, but it was when I first started out with the band. And you learn, you know, okay, you're a young player. You learn, you throw out everything you know, like everything with the kitchen sink, trying to impress people or work your skills or whatever.
Oh, yeah. And I did
and
it
then,
too, man. I did
yeah.
it too.
But then after a while, you're like, well, I don't need to work all that. I mean, it's good to have it in your arsenal, like, okay, let me throw that out now. But, you know, you don't want to throw it all out at once because that's not the point. Otherwise, you end up like, this is a band we saw in the city. They opened up for Epica and Visions of Atlantis called Unexpect, right? They're great.
Yeah, I've heard of
great
it from
players.
Canada, yeah.
Fantastic players, right? The stuff that they do on the 7-string guitar and the bass and all that is mind-boggling. I saw them from like 2 feet away doing this stuff, and I'm like, wow. But the
mm-hmm.
music, I can't listen to the music. It's not really, there's no harmony, there's no melody. It's just like, let's impress everybody. It's like math metal, you know? Let's impress everybody with how fast and how many jagged rhythms we can throw in. Oh, here's a polyrhythm, you know, whatever. Well, that's nice if you're like a hardcore techie musician, but everybody else is just going to go, what?
Yes.
You know, try
that
playing that on the radio.
Definitely has an audience.
Exactly. Try playing on the radio. It's not going to happen.
Oh, yeah. And like I said, I appreciate some technical bands. I mean, I do. I've listened to bands like Toxic and...
Oh, Toxic was great.
And Death Row from Germany.
Right.
And, well, and Corner was a technical. Even though they were kind of straight ahead technical, they were still very technical.
Right.
And Atheist was really a
right.
great band. And still, I bought
and
their new album.
Cynic. They're still killer.
Cynic is great. Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, they're amazing. And, you know, and I appreciate that, too. I mean, that's just part of the...
it's like the power,
me liking
you know?
A bunch of different shit. Yeah, and
exactly.
sometimes I feel like listening to something technical or whatever, but I guess with what I wanted to play, and there was a time when I tried to play really technical, and I'm like, you know, this is just not me. This is...
Right.
My thing is more of a straight-ahead song kind of thing, and... You know, and I'll leave the technical, and I've got some friends who play in technical bands, and I know they'll
right.
get pissed off sometimes because they feel like, it's like some people don't get it or whatever.
Right.
And they'll be mad, and it's kind of like, hey, man, you can't, you got to just, you know what you're getting into when you do this.
Exactly.
You got to just,
you know,
go with it.
You're not really making a song. You're just there to impress people with how good you are. It's like jazz, you know, like, okay, you're a great player. Okay, and is the mass audience going to listen to this? I mean, yeah, okay, no, none of this stuff is out to the mass audience anymore, but, you know, the bulk of people that are going to sit there and listen, they want to go and see songs and sing along. They don't want us to be sitting there doing an atheist track because it's not going to, you know, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, you know, a band that really amazes me is Rush.
Yes.
How they managed to combine the best of both worlds with, like,
exactly,
super catchy songs, but yet this extreme technicality.
Right.
That is, man,
especially
they're like
on the
just one in a million. I mean, really.
Especially
I,
on the drums, because Neil Peart is just incredible. And yet,
I mean, he is.
And yet, I would not consider him the best drum I've ever heard, because, you know, there's people that can actually have more soul than him, because he even admits it himself that he gets too wrapped up in the technical thing and trying to, he's playing, if you listen to it, despite the fact that he's amazing and he's definitely one of my favorite drummers technically, it's very stiff.
Oh yeah, sure.
You know, and he knows it. He's like, well, you know, I need to get more groove into it, because there's players out there that can play just as good as him in a different style and yet have more groove and soul to it. And, you know, so again, it's like there's always this balance, like, okay, where you really want to go with this? Do you want to leave it out there and impress all the musicos and all the jazz bows and all the guys that are going there, like, oh, let me see if they can beat me, you know, like a pissing contest, you know? Or do you want to go and say, let me make a song that's going to resonate, and maybe, you know, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, somebody will be singing along to this still and want to see me when I'm 50 and 60 years old, like, you know, be going out there on a tour again? Because are you really you know, are you really going to get somebody who wants to go out there and see, you know, like a technical death metal band 20 or 30 years on? Maybe, but it won't be a big audience. It'll be a certain group. So, you know, that's...
Well, you know, I'll tell you this. I know when I first got into Cannibal Corpse, I never would have thought they would have lasted as long as they have.
Right.
And I mean that in no disrespect to them. It's just, maybe I just didn't think about that as a teenager. But, I mean, I think they're probably more shocked than anybody that they're still going.
Yeah,
and, you know, that's one of those things you just never, never know.
Exactly.
I mean, there's bands that I thought were just, I just knew they were going to take the world over, and they didn't. And then there's bands who you thought they wouldn't last another year. And, yeah, it's so strange. The funny thing is, people have asked me before, like, how did you guys get through this, or how did you play this show or get this tour or do this? And it's like, man, I almost don't even know what to tell them. I mean, you know, there's a certain amount of just luck involved
with
the whole thing. I mean, you got to promote yourself and all that, right. But people just, it's just really, it's an unpredictable thing
it's
to do.
You
just don't know what's going to happen.
And to close out our interview with Chris, there's another track from Widow on the On Fire album. Stay tuned after the wrap for one more track from Widow's newest record, Life's Blood. But right now, this is Widow with An American Werewolf in Raleigh.
The supernatural, the power of darkness, it's all true. The undead surround me. Have you ever talked to a corpse? It's boring. I'm lonely. Take your life, David. Kill yourself before you kill others.
There's something wrong with this place.
Wrong in this place.
Thanks for joining us tonight. We hope you enjoyed our interviews with Alex Gutierrez of Morfeli, Jason Decay of Cauldron, and Chris Bennett of Widow. Next week on week 25 of Third Eye Cinema, Dan Cleary of Canadian metal band Stryker. If you'd like to contact us here, comments, suggestions, or you're a filmmaker or musician like to join us on air, email us at thirdeyecinema@hotmail.com or visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/thirdeyecinema. Third Eye Cinema brought to you by the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Judgment Day. here's one last track from Cauldron. This is I Confess. This or any other Third Eye Cinema broadcast, just visit our Facebook page for links to the shows in question. All Blog Talk Radio shows are available for archive listener download at your convenience. See you next week.